This is Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is a special broadcast from the grounds of Ohio State University at the 2019 Chadwick Arboretum plant sale. We're talking about soil today. Ratan Lal is Distinguished University Professor of Soil Science and the Director of the Carbon Management and Sequestration Center at Ohio State. He is a leading voice on issues related to climate change and soil carbon, soil degradation and restoration, food security and environmental quality, and sustainability. As part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2007. And he is the recipient of the very prestigious 2019 Japan Prize, one of the top science and technology prizes in the world. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, Ratan Lal.
Thank you.
Dr. Lal, what is soil? What do we mean by it? I guess what's the difference between soil and dirt, maybe?
Oh, that's a very good question. Soil is a living entity. Soil is the basis of all terrestrial life. Dirt is just the opposite. We should never treat our soil like dirt. Soil is the upper layer of the earth crust on which all terrestrial life depends for its existence, for nutrient, for water, for foothold as a habitat. Soil is the only place in the universe that I know where death transformed into life. So soil is a living entity. Everything that is organic eventually ends up into the soil that recycles it back into the new life through plant growth. So in terms of the connection between soil and environment, the health of soil, plants, animal, people, and environment is one and indivisible.
What makes soil living?
Soil organic matter content, which in an ideal soil should be about 3, 4, 5% organic matter content in the root zone, at least the surface layer. That is the source of energy for all microorganisms. Mesobiota and macroorganisms like earthworm, termites, centipedes, other than the fungi and bacteria in the soil. Those are the living entities. As they consume organic matter, they respire. So soil also respires. In fact, we monitor soil respiration rate.
It's like breathing.
Like breathing, exactly. Soil breathes. Organisms in soil take oxygen and they breathe out carbon dioxide. And that is the index of soil health, the microbial activity as monitored by the respiration quotient.
I was reading that back, you know, thousands of years ago, that top layer of soil was much deeper than it is now around much of the world. What's happened?
I think as the human transformed the natural vegetation like forest in Ohio, prairie in the further further western part, and converted to agriculture. Soil became susceptible to erosion by water, by wind. Soil was also compacted. So the topsoil layer has been lost. The current estimate of soil erosion is about 75 million tons a year. That's quite high rate.
And when it erodes, what happens to what's been eroded? I mean, could it ostensibly be collected and restored?
It could be, but it would be a humongous task. I think the best thing to do is protect soil erosion. Prevention is much better than cure in this particular case. I used to monitor the rate of soil erosion in several soils in Africa, West Africa, and many times torrential rain of African high intensity climatic storm would cause erosion about 20, 30, 50, up to 100 tons per hectare per year. And that's quite high rate. So many soil that are started in a very good state, in about 15, 20 years, the topsoil was gone.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are broadcasting. It's a special broadcast from the grounds of the Ohio State University where we're watching people pour over the thousands of plants at the annual spring plant sale for Chadwick Arboretum. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about soil. It doesn't get anything more basic than that. It's kind of the bottom line for everything that happens on Earth. And my guest is the guy to talk to. He is a distinguished university professor of soil science and the director of the Carbon Management and Sequestration Center at Ohio State. He is the recipient of the very prestigious 2019 Japan Prize, one of the top science and technology prizes in the world, and also as part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. How does geography affect those properties? Because we hear about where there are deserts now, there were what was once, you know, incalculable, almost fertile land. What happens? Why does it go away?
That is a time, temporal change in climate over millions and hundreds of millions of years and billion times. So, for example, Sahara, at some time it was habitable vegetation. In fact, in Niamey, I went to a museum and here was a big dinosaur dug up in the middle of the desert.
So something must have been eating something.
So those are the geologic change in climate that has happened. And that's a natural process. What we are talking right now is the human-induced climate change. There's a difference between the two. The geologic is what we call the normal greenhouse effect. When the rate of change in temperature is less than 0.1 degree centigrade per decade or 1 degree centigrade per century, right now it is 0.2 degree centigrade per decade because of human-induced changes.
A lot of people think when we talk about that, we think about, you know, fossil fuels and the burning of fossil fuels. And what's interesting about what you talk about is it's the soil and how we treat our soil is as much an issue as burning of fossil fuels.
Very much so. The soil has been a source of CO2, carbon dioxide, and other gases, methane, nitrous oxide, since the agriculture began about 10,000 years ago. So the total amount of carbon lost from soil and vegetation together by human activity is somewhere about 500 to 600 gigaton.
Gigatons.
Yeah, compared with fossil fuels since 1750, which is still about 450 or 480 gigaton. Much more, I'm thinking about that from my memory. So at present, the total loss from the terrestrial biosphere, soil and vegetation, is still more than what we lost from fossil fuel. But the difference is if we manage our land resources properly, what we have lost, we can put it back. In fact, we must put it back if we want to mitigate climate change. Recarbonization of the terrestrial biosphere is the important solution.
Recarbonization of the terrestrial biosphere.
Soil and vegetation. Soil and forest is very important part. We estimated, several of my colleagues, about 10-15 of us, globally, if we restore soil and biota together, we have a potential of putting together about 330 gigaton of carbon back into the terrestrial biosphere.
How do you do that?
Well,
or do you, as you mentioned earlier, prevention is better than trying to come
with
the cure.
Keep the ground covered.
Yeah.
Do not disturb. Recycle all the biomass. Agriculture can be, should be, must be solution to the climate change. In fact, agriculture is very important. After all, we have to eat food. We can't do without food. Therefore, we cannot always keep blaming agriculture. We have to make sure that agriculture is an important part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, adopting better agriculture practice is a solution to most environmental issues. Water quality, erosion control, climate change adaptation mitigation, biodiversity, aesthetic value of the landscape itself. The solution lies in improved science-based agriculture.
I've been hearing about science-based agriculture for most of my adult life. I mean, it's not a new concept. Why the slow uptake? What do we understand about why?
Well, we are now thinking about new innovative technology. You mentioned in the beginning, and we are talking no-till agriculture, which, by the way, is developed at Ohio State. In 1943, we had an extension agronomist at Ohio State, Edward Faulkner. He was the one who wrote a book called The Plowman's Folly. Mm-hmm. the comment he raised was that weed control, if we know how to do it, there is no reason for plowing. That concept was also came out from England. There was a soil scientist named B.A. Keene, who back in 1918 mentioned the same thing. The major reason we plow is weed control. Now the weed control have been happening by herbicides. Now herbicides have their own limitations, of course, for weed control. Mm-hmm. If we can think about biological methods of weed control as one plant suppressing another plant through cover crops.
That's what a weed is, one you don't want.
That is really the most best way to do that. And therefore the cover cropping, growing crops in the off season, which are primarily for nutrient control, management, retention rather than leakage into the environment, and weed control is the best option. Another reason the no-till, as we were talking, has not really gotten very far as much as it should, is sometimes the yield can be less.
A lower yield, but...
It can happen. Not always, but sometimes it does happen, and yield obviously is an important factor. I think here is what we should realize, that the idea is not to grow the maximum yield, but the idea is to produce optimum yield and sustain it.
Sustainable optimum yield.
That's the goal. That should be the goal, sustainable optimum yield.
Does it matter that so much of our crops now are soybeans and corn versus greater variety?
It does. More diverse the cropping system, the better the soil.
Why is that?
Well, because monocrops always lead to certain, like we are talking about weeds. Some weeds can become persistent with a monoculture. If we have a diverse weed, then the pest problem is much less. There's a concept called push and pull system. Some of the plants can attract insects rather than going to crops. Some alternate host, if we can.
So you grow something with it that attracts the bugs away from the corn.
It can be grown on the borders
of,
for example. Okay. And they can attract the bugs. That's the concept called push and pull system. I'm not a specialist in insects and pests, but that's the concept behind it. So more diverse the system, more acceptable it is from the environmental point of view.
What about the role of kind of these ancillary things like insects and what we think of as pests? How do they play a role in the soil? I would imagine
what we call pests, nature has something
right.
So I think we have to be careful what we kill when we apply pesticides and herbicides. Blanket killing of everything. You remember the book by Rachel Carson,
right?
The Silent Spring.
Spring, right.
I think each species, and there are 8.7 billion of them, they have some use in nature. They are part of nature.
Right.
So are we. We are also part of nature. And I think this is where the different concept. If humanity thinks we are part of nature, then the nature conservation and anything that benefits nature would also benefit humanity. And that's a very different concept.
My guest is Ratan Lal. He's a distinguished university professor of soil science and director of the Carbon Management and Sequestration Center at Ohio State. He's a pretty special guy. He was just awarded the very prestigious 2019 Japan Prize, one of the top science and technology prizes in the world. He's a leading voice on issues related to climate change and soil carbon, soil degradation and restoration, food security and environmental quality and sustainability, all of which we're talking about today when we talk about soil. If you have a question or comment, you can join the conversation. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is a special broadcast from the Chadwick Arboretum plant sale on the OSU campus. For more information about where to go and if you want to join us here, check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. We're talking about soil today and how it plays a role in the issue of climate change and how all of that plays a role in the kind of food we eat and the kind of food we'll be able to grow in the future generations. OSU Distinguished Professor Ratan Lal is Director of the Carbon Management and Sequestration Center at Ohio State. He's a leading voice on issues related to climate change and soil carbon, soil degradation and restoration, food security and environmental quality and sustainability. As a part of the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007, and he is the recipient of the prestigious 2019 Japan Prize, one of the top science and technology prizes in the world. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Lau, when soil loses its carbon stock, what's happening to the soil? Is it dying?
The critical threshold level for carbon in soil is about 2%, 2 to 2.5%. Many soil that I have seen in resource-poor farmers, Africa, Caribbeans, South Asia, carbon concentration will be 0.1%, 0.05%. That soil is technically close to death.
Wow, okay.
Because soil carbon is food for microorganisms.
Okay.
Without microorganisms, the soil processes cannot continue. Therefore, extractive farming practices are indiscriminate use of chemical. And I want to say indiscriminate.
Yeah.
Because when you keep dumping without realizing whether they are needed or not, and proper application. So they can have adverse impact. Soil erosion, for example, can deplete the organic carbon content. So we must make sure that the soils have carbon concentration in the root zone about 2% to 2.5%. Fortunately, in Midwest, especially in Ohio, our farmers are doing a very good job. Our extension service at Ohio State has done an excellent job in promoting good management systems. So our soil carbon status for our soil is good, but it can be better. Certainly it can be improved. And improving carbon sequestration soil has a win-win-win option. It improves use efficiency of fertilizers and other inputs. It improves crop productivity. And of course it improves climate change by sequestering carbon from atmosphere, putting back into the soil. So it also buys us time until no carbon fuel sources take effect. So it's really the best option, putting carbon back in the terrestrial biosphere.
Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question is, a friend told me about a test there at OSU and some of your fields using a product called biochar. It's charcoal that you put back into the soil.
Yes.
And I just wondered if you could talk about that and what were the results of that test.
Yeah. Well, we did an experiment. I had two students. Ryan Huttle was one and Chris was another student. Two, three students. Samantha, they all worked on that project. The biochar we applied at our Waterman farm here was not the best biochar that I now think we should have used. It was mostly a charcoal that they used and broke it up into pieces. Biochar is something which is produced through pyrolysis at high temperature, like 400-500 degrees Celsius, and under low oxygen condition. So it's incomplete combustion of biomass, and the resultant byproduct is what we call biochar. So biochar has a large surface area. It is recalcitrant to decomposition. It can absorb nutrients and other chemicals and keep them there rather than washing away. It has some benefit. For infertile soils of the tropics, the crop yield can be drastically improved. Our experiments here for good soil, we had increase about 6 to 8% in corn and soybean. And that is because our soils are good, fertile, and have good organic carbon content. In infertile, poor soils, and drought-prone soil, the impact can be much more.
Thanks a lot for that call. If you have a question or comment, the number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What does drought and too much rain, what's the relationship there? How does
That's a very good question. Drought and floods are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
If soil is not managed properly, during the summertime, rainless period, we'll be suffering from drought. If it is not managed properly during the rainfall period, we'll be suffering from floods. So the drought-flood syndrome is part of the mismanagement of the soil resources and misland use. Drought is a condition in which the water required for adequate plant growth through roots in the topsoil is not enough to meet the evapotranspiration demand. Droughts are several kinds. We have meteorological drought when the long-term rainfall decreases.
Okay.
We have hydrological drought when the long-term stream flow decreases. We have pedological drought when the soil water capacity decreases because the organic carbon was less. Therefore, soil did not absorb water.
Okay.
We have agronomic drought when the water required at a given stage of crop growth was not enough. And we have sociological drought when people misuse the water and create drought. So we should be concerned very seriously about the situation if we suffer from meteorological and hydrological drought. They are long-term problems.
And they're things that we can affect.
Yes, and we have been having those in our western region. We have long period. Texas had those kind of drought. The short period drought are simply problems of soil mismanagement. And we can store more water in soil if we manage them properly.
Why can you store more water in soil? Why does carbon affect the ability to...
Carbon is a sponge. It has a very large surface area. It can absorb water and hold water, both against gravity and against evaporation. So not only the clay, but the organic matter combined together improve the water holding capacity of the soil. I see we have a mulch on the ground in front of us here. Putting mulch on the soil, crop residue from cover crop, any kind of that will eventually become into soil, is a very good way to hold water in the soil.
We have an email from David. He writes, soil on property contains a lot of clay, and each year he adds topsoil. It looks better this year, but it's still clumpy. Is there anything else I can add or do to improve soil quality? So
yes.
Can average home gardeners do something to improve
certainly.
It?
Put all the biomass crop residue, even lawn clipping back on the soil. I see sometimes lawn clipping put in the bags and taken away.
Yeah.
They should be left back on the land. Sometimes they can suppress lawn growth.
Yeah.
But if
you
growing
wait too long to mow your lawn, right.
Yeah, so they, certainly that's what should be put back on the lawn.
Okay, so bring it, put it right into your garden lot.
On your garden where you're growing tomatoes.
Okay.
And I would like to do that too.
Yeah.
The other day I asked my neighbor if they had a big bag of crop residue and grass cutting, and I said, can I take it to put in my lawn? And they put
like,
me to
are
do
you crazy?
That. That is the material that is good for soil, and we should value that and use it.
And yet we've normalized this process of taking it away.
Yeah, that's a kind of our lawn and our agricultural land should always be protected, and the best protection is biomass, crop residue, anything that can keep the ground. The sun, rain, wind, change in temperature, soil should be protected from them.
This is a question I've often wondered about. You know, when you look at something like, say, the Euphrates River, and they talk about it being sort of the breadbasket, and then you go beyond it, and it goes right from super lush green to desert.
Yeah. How,
why doesn't it work? It's like the desert's encroaching on this healthy soil.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the healthy soil encroach on the desert?
Right. Well, I'm going to give an example of a wall.
Okay.
And I'm not making a political statement. We are promoting through United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification a green wall across the Sahel. It is across the Sahel to stop Sahara spreading southward. And the idea is from Senegal to Somalia, the entire Sahel region, about 100 kilometer wide, 50 kilo green vegetation to stop spread of the Sahara. And that's called green wall.
A good wall.
A good wall.
Well, how do you do that?
Established vegetation, controlled grazing, planting trees which are shrubs, which are adapted to that environment. And that is the best way to stop encroachment of the desert environment. So that is desertification control. And I think this is a kind of concept, how to use nature to work in favor of us. So we work with nature. So green wall is a natural system to stop desertification.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are broadcasting, and it's a special broadcast from the grounds of the 2019 Chadwick Arboretum annual plant sale. So it's on the OSU campus. If you want to learn more about where we're at and want to join us, do. It's on from, today, tomorrow, and... today and tomorrow, I guess, is when it's running. So check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and you'll get all the information you need there. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. I was talking with somebody this morning who's from Texas, lives in Texas. She was talking about how green it is here and how wonderful it is, and that in Texas, they just, you know, people try to plant Midwestern types of shrubs and trees, and they don't flourish there. Is it, when you talk about working with nature instead of working against it, is it then the idea is, say, in Texas where it's dry, and to go with the native vegetation and and that has a lot to do with our aesthetics about all of this. It doesn't look as pretty maybe to us.
I think we must adapt the species which easily grow there. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a desert, dry environment, and there are certain species which are really very adaptable, and they grow very nicely, including fruit trees, which are adaptable under those conditions. Mm-hmm. There was an article came out from Israel a few years ago that establishing shrubs and vegetation are growing under the can sequester carbon at a very reasonable rate, even in dry environments, provided that the trees are adaptable to those conditions. And these trees and shrubs, they have deep roots. Therefore, they can tap water from the deeper layers. And there are many systems by which the water actually moves from deeper layer to the surface layer at night when the temperature reversal happens. And those water vapor are preferentially condensed on the roots of those plants. Therefore, they survive that way. Like similar things like some of the beetles do. Mm-hmm. They collect condensed water on the backs of their body, and then that water is used for them.
So if you're taking a plant that's used to one kind of environment and trying to make it grow and nurturing it and doing whatever you have to do to make it grow in an environment that it's not native to, is that doing any damage?
It can. Some plants can become invasive under wrong environments. The typical example is kudzu. As many of you who drive around Georgia know, kudzu was introduced as a possible system to control erosion. It was a wrong species. It was Puraria javanica rather than Puraria physalides. A wrong species created that problem. Hmm. Other example is a Hupatorium species. Spread throughout West Africa. The soldiers coming from Burma after World War II brought on their feet, on their shoes. And that became... So wrong species can cause a lot of... But the species which are locally adaptable to those conditions, nurture them, adapt them, make sure they get established very well, that's a very good option to promote local species under those conditions. I think they can also recycle nutrients, change the temperature conditions and so forth, add organic matter to the soil. When we are talking about carbon in soil, there are two types of carbon. I have been talking only about organic carbon, which is a humus.
Organic carbon,
And there's the inorganic carbon.
Okay.
In the desert environment, there's the inorganic carbon. And that's inorganic carbon, it's carbonates and bicarbonates. Now, carbonates and bicarbonates also change in soil. They can also emit CO2 back in the atmosphere, but they can also sequester CO2 from the atmosphere, put it back in the carbon,
okay,
into the soil. So in the desert environment, if you can promote somehow sequestration of inorganic carbon, both by biotic and abiotic means, that's also carbon sequestration.
And how would you do that? What would be planting native plants? I mean,
Inorganic carbon sequestration would be essentially dissolving CO2 from the atmosphere, making carbonic acid, and that precipitates with calcium, magnesium to make calcium carbonate. We call that secondary carbonates. But the point I want to make is there are 67 million square kilometers of desert area in the world. And the desert area is changing with change in climate. It's increasing, in fact. So by 2100, we may have 50% of the world land area as a dry lands. So managing dry lands and learning how to adapt and mitigate certain conditions in dry land is a very important part of soil and natural resource management. So dry land is a component which we really have to begin to understand and adapt and learn more.
Do you see a time when we're going to have more crops grown indoors and artificially grown? I mean, artificially lighted.
Oh, you brought a very good point, urban agriculture, in a way, which I think indoor would be part. Urban agriculture certainly is a very important part. We have mega cities right now, many of them, I think 28 at the moment. A mega city is a city with more than 10 million people.
Okay.
A city of 10 million people requires 6,000 tons of food per day. That much amount of food bringing nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, especially phosphorus, which is a very kind of a not very extensive resource. There are few countries, five to be exact, which have most of the phosphate reserve. So recycling those nutrients and water in the city to produce perhaps 10-15% of green food within the city boundary by recycling the nutrients is the solution for our growing city. So urban agriculture is going to play more and more role in terms of advancing food security and improving the environment. Right now, these nutrients coming to cities are liability in many cases, especially in developing countries. When they are not managed properly, they are cause of pollution and disease.
Right, when they're just thrown away.
Then thrown away,
and
that happened. So somehow our system of sewer management, we have to think so that we can collect these nutrients and recycle them. So the original thinking of food comes from grocery store, maybe we have to make it look happen. So the lower part of the grocery store grows food, and the upper part sells it. Yes.
We are talking about soil today. It's everything. It's the start of every equation when it comes to our survival on Earth. My guest is Ratan Lal. He's a distinguished university professor of soil science and director of the Carbon Management and Sequestration Center at Ohio State. He is the recipient of the very prestigious 2019 Japan Prize, one of the top science and technology prizes in the world. He is a leading voice on issues related to climate change and soil carbon, soil degradation and restoration, food security and environmental quality and sustainability. We're really lucky to have him on the show today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8 513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We are broadcasting from the OSU plant sale at the Chadwick it's the Chadwick Arboretum plant sale on the OSU campus. We're talking about nature's building block, soil, what makes it good, how to improve it, and how to protect it in a way that's going to make sure we'll be eating and feeding enough people 50 years from now. Still with us is OSU Distinguished Professor Ratan Lal. He is Director of the Carbon Management and Sequestration Center at Ohio State. As a part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. And he's the recipient of the prestigious 2019 Japan Prize, one of the top science and technology prizes in the world. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Lal, let's talk about urban agriculture, because when we think of growing food, we mostly think of it in the farm fields of wherever. We were off air when you started talking about how we could eventually be growing food in the basement of a grocery store and selling it up on the main floor. I mean, that's pretty radical sounding, but it makes a lot of sense too.
I'm speaking as a soil scientist.
Uh-huh.
Soil has many, many uses other than growing food. Did you know 95% of our antibiotics come from soil?
Antibiotics, yeah.
All
okay.
of them come from soil. So soil being such a precious and very finite resource, we want to save it forever, not only spoil it just for agriculture for the current needs. Therefore, soil-less agriculture.
Okay. Hydroponics, that kind of a thing?
Hydroponics, uh-huh. aquaponics, aeroponics, which would fit very well under urban agriculture system, to me, is an alternative to save and protect soil for other uses.
And when you're doing it in an urban center, then it affects the transportation of it
exactly.
as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Another issue.
Yeah, which is very important. And recycling the nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
Urban agriculture can really go beyond green grocery and so forth. We could also use it for producing biofuel, biomass.
Mm-hmm.
Algae growth, for example, mm-hmm. the water and nutrients which have been contaminated by human use could be used for that purpose as well. So urban agriculture has many facets. We have many cities where the downtown area is no longer what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those buildings are really can be demolished, changed, and used for green space and converted into agricultural ecosystems. So urban agriculture also could also mean agriculture on the rooftop. Greenhouses on the buildings, on the roof, of course, in the lawns and so forth, home gardens are very critical. I think if each one of us had a small garden to produce food, the food security issue we are talking about for 11.4 billion people by the end of this century could be an important step in that direction.
At the same time, what a wonderful thought.
Save and protect soil source. Fresh tomatoes grown in your own garden.
Nothing
and
like
cucumber
it.
And so forth. I think we should train our younger generation that they should be, as their kindergarten exercise, how to transplant tomato.
Uh-huh.
That'd be an excellent experience for them.
Let's see. We've got Gerald in Clintonville on the air. Hi, Gerald. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have a question for you. For decades, we've been running a compost pile, putting leaves and the banana peels in it. And in recent years, the garden has produced far less vegetables than it used to. And I'm wondering, what's the problem?
My garden had the same problem. I do not have enough compost to put on it. I think keeping soil very good, fluffy structure, more organic matter content in the soil, so the earthworms. If your garden soil has a lot of earthworm, that's a good indication it's a good soil. If you see after rainfall, the soil got crusted and compacted, you obviously have a soil which needs more organic matter content. Trampling effect, you know, when we keep walking on the same spot in the garden, we got a small spot, and human traffic, which quite a lot on our home garden, that's another issue. I think having a plank or maybe small stepping stone, say you step always on those areas, so the soil.
You mean even if you're not stepping on the plant, you're
yeah.
still compacting the
well,
soil around it sometimes.
Sure.
Yeah.
You're walking around on the soil, right. especially wet soil. Yesterday, last afternoon, if you walk around your plot after rain, you're making a lot more damage. So if I could put a plank where I can walk in between my tomato plants, that would be one option to avoid the compaction. I think those are some of the issues that you might want to consider. Because it's a small place, you want to preserve it, protect it, make sure earthworms are in a happy mood.
Earthworms are happy. Make those earthworms happy. Gerald, thank you so much for that call. Let's see. Terry in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Ratan Lal. Hi, Terry.
Hey, good morning, Dr. Lou. Yeah. And Ann, it is an honor to speak with you. Please give us your thoughts on Roundup and this approach to agriculture.
Roundup has certainly facilitated weed control. There's no question about that. I like to compare that with aspirin. You take one aspirin and it cures your headache temporarily. You take 100 aspirin indiscriminately, you know what that does. I think any technology used without wisdom creates a problem. So used discriminately, properly, judiciously, as required, it can be useful. Used improperly at rates and time which are not appropriate, it can cause damage. Technology without wisdom is an issue that we must take into consideration.
Thanks a lot for that call, Terry. We do have a little bit of time left. If you do have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, you won the Japan Prize in part for your adaption of the no-till cultivation method. We've talked about that a little bit already on the program, but there are other aspects to it. I mean, just for the home gardener, one of the things I know Deborah Knapke, who's a frequent guest on the show, she has said is don't clean up your garden. Don't clean your garden to death at the end of the season. Leave it in over the season for many reasons. The soil, the insects that might be growing on those plants and that kind of a thing. What are your thoughts about how we clean up and everything's just super tidy in our gardens? And gardens can be a little messy, right?
Our garden is not our living room. I think we must keep the garden always covered by crop residue, by weed, by any material, by compost. Keep the ground covered. Same thing in agricultural land. We must keep that land covered. Do not keep the land uncovered at any time. Rainfall, excessive sun, wind. Soil is a living entity, the microorganism, the earthworms. I used to have an experiment in Africa and also here at Coshocton, Ohio, where we took away deliberately the crop residue, everything. We removed it away.
Okay.
And in Africa, after 15 years of doing this, the soil was practically dead. It was compacted, hard, crusted. Even this fertilizer input would not make any impact. The plants were stunted. The roots were not growing very well. Drought was a serious problem. We made that soil practically unfunctional. I also had an experiment where I tried to use some chemical to control nematodes. And I used excessive rate because I practically killed that soil. The nematicide in a soil which is low clay content, low organic matter content, poisoned out all the animals in the soil, micro and other. So we got to be very careful, be very proper rates of use of some of these pesticides and herbicides for no-till control. If we can use biological systems of weed control, that's the best option. In that case, It is very possible that there may be some yield reduction. So I'm willing to take optimal yield at lower level, 5-10%.
Because it's more sustainable.
And sustain forever.
Right, right. Gotcha.
I'd like to, Anne mentioned you gave me credit for Japan Prize. I would like to say, mention the credit where it is due, and it's due to Ohio State University, my alma mater. It is the opportunity provided to me by my department, School of Environment and Natural Resources, by my college, the Food, Agriculture, and Environment Sciences, and by the university, the Ohio State University. It is that stamp of Ohio State on me that made those awards possible. And I think that is a very important part that I feel proud being a Buckeye, and that is a part I would like to mention into your show, that 350 scientist, researcher, postdoctor, graduate student, technician, office manager, who make all, do hard work and make that possible. Therefore, I did not feel appropriate morally that the money was mine. I accepted on their behalf.
And you returned it.
And therefore, it will return back to the carbon center.
That's right. Dr. Michael Drake told me about that. Yeah.
It is the money that belongs truly to Ohio State, and that's where it will go.
David in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask your speaker what he thought about the patenting of varieties of food crops around the world.
You mean like the Monsanto thing?
Exactly.
Okay. How they're patented, how they patent and own the rights to food. So the seeds.
I'm not a legal person, so I think that question probably not something that I can answer. But I think we should respect, just like we respect intellectual rights, I think the companies, organizations who patent them, they should be respected as long as they do not restrict the use of certain technology. Sometimes they can become inaccessible to some farmers. As long as that is not the case, I think the intellectual property rights, the other patents should be respectable and respected by those who are using those property rights. But as I mentioned, I'm not competent in the legal issues, so I really do not know.
Is there an issue, though, just in general, just about owning the rights? I mean, one of the issues you talked about earlier was biodiversity, and there are seed banks now in the world because there is such a huge concern about the lack of diversity.
Yeah. Yes.
A lot of that is driven by these legal ramifications of these patents.
Right. I think the issue really comes back to how do we use modern technology innovation to make sure that the biodiversity is maintained. We have 8.7 million forms of life, and we are losing them at a very high rate. That is a major concern. We must make sure that the species are maintained. Coming back to soil, just like species can go extinct, and there are endangered species, do you know that soil can also go extinct, and there are endangered soil? So we should be really very careful in using technology that preserves, restores, protects the soil and the species equally. While I'm at that subject, I'm writing now, just before coming here today, an article which I hope to publish soon. It's called Rights of Soil.
Rights of Soil.
Okay. Rights of Nature.
Uh-huh.
We are not just the human rights, not just the animal rights, rights of nature, rights of soil. Soil, nature should have a right to be protected, restored, thrive, protected against abused, misused, improperly used. Why not? A polluter should be punished just like anything else we damage and hurt. And so I think the nature should be. So going back to that question, it's not a question of patent, it's a question of how to use technology properly. So rights of nature, rights of soil, rights of all species, all 8.7 million of them are protected.
Dr. Ratan Lal, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a delight. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Ratan Lal. He is director of the Carbon Management and Sequestration Center at Ohio State. He is, as part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. He's a recipient of the very prestigious 2019 Japan Prize, one of the top science and technological prizes in the world. And as he so humbly mentioned, there's 350 people behind him on that score at Ohio State University, where he teaches and studies. Thanks for listening today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.